So, Judges chapter 6, we left off kind of in the middle of the chapter last week, but the description in the beginning of the chapter is that the Midianites have come in and taken over the land. And in another part of the chapter, there was a group, you know, two or three that kind of went together, but these were nomadic peoples. And so, you know, this was not a regional enemy. This was a nomadic people that had invaded. And Gideon was threshing wheat in the wine press, an unusual place for it, but he was just trying to hide it. They just showed up at harvest time and stole everything or destroyed what they didn't want as a way of oppressing Israel. So the Lord showed up, appeared to Gideon, called him a mighty man of valor, and said, "Hey, you're going to deliver Israel." And he's like, "You talking to me?" And so he asked this man, he's trying to figure out who he was, he asked this man if he would stay while he prepared food for him. And in verse number 20, the angel of the Lord instructed him to put the meat and the bread on the rock, and then he calls fire to come out of the rock and consume it as a sacrifice. Well, that's when Gideon figured out, hey, this is God that appeared to me. And I think this was an appearance of God in a human form. And then God disappeared. Verse 22, when Gideon perceived he was an angel of the Lord, Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen an angel of the Lord face to face." And the Lord said unto him, "Peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die." Verse 24, Gideon built an altar there unto the Lord and called it Jehovah Shalom. You know the word shalom means peace or wholeness. And I think that's directly related to the fact in verse 23, God said, "Peace be unto you, you're not going to die." Okay, but that's where we left off last week in verse 24. Unto this day it is yet an Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Verse 25, it came to pass the same night, the Lord said unto him, "Take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it, and build an altar unto the Lord thy God on the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove, which thou shalt cut down." Okay, so the second bullock, you know, they would have a lead animal and a second bullock, but here it says it's 7 years old. Now, I have not trained any animals other than possibly a dog, and I've not done that very well. Okay, so I don't pretend to know, you know, how long it takes. You want to know how long it takes to break in a horse and really train them? Talk to Dr. Scoville. He has, you know, all the background and stories about all those kinds of things. You want to know what it takes to train chickens? Talk to Pastor Stevens. He has all the experience with that. So I'm not sure if he's training them or they've trained him, but it's kind of fun to watch either way. They're training you? Okay. But, you know, I would imagine that it takes a period of time. You know, even if you get them, if I could say it this way, cooperative, you know, there's a difference with an animal between being cooperative and then being just, you know, constantly cooperative, don't fight you on anything, and dependable, and then an animal you can use to help train others. You know, it takes a while to get to that point. So what I'm saying is, if this second bullock of 7 years old, it should be at this point trained in, broken in, and had a few more years of good service in front of it yet, that would have been a significant loss for his dad. Also, if you think about it in the context of, you know, being oppressed, losing any of your, if I could say it this way, losing your farm equipment was a bad thing. I mean, the bullocks that pulled the plows would be the equivalents of the tractors and combines for us today, right? And so, but here, Gideon was instructed by God to take his father's bullock and throw down the altar of Baal. Notice the next phrase, "that thy father hath." That's interesting, isn't it? It was his dad's altar. It was on his dad's property anyway. Okay? So, at a minimum, his dad tolerated it. I mean, the way this is worded, it's as though his dad was prominent in the Baal worship of the day. Okay? So, you know, if you think about it, I mean, for many of you, I'm sure you wish you could still talk to mom and dad, but you can't. You know, but if you think of it back in the day, I mean, Gideon's a, an adult, but his dad's still living. And I mean, just think about a prized possession of your dad's, whether it was the shop or the barn, you know, his tools, his computer, you know, the car that he worked on, whatever was a prized possession of your dad. Think about going and destroying it completely, setting it on fire, stealing everything, you know, just completely destroying it, and then saying, "Hi, Dad, how are you? Did you hear what happened to my barn? Yeah, I burned it down." I mean, even as an adult, I wouldn't want to face my dad and have to answer for that, right? I mean, there's kind of that, you know, that built-in you know, fear of consequences in the back of your mind. I say that to say that he did it at night, but I'm not shocked about that. But at the same time, you know, there is a respect for family and a love for family. And, you know, this is going to feel like doing something disrespectful and offensive. And yet God told him, "I want you to go do this." What he had to understand was that the expectation was his loyalty to God was higher than his loyalty to any other man. He said, "Hey, I want you to go tear down your father's altar." That would have been traumatic. That would have been significant. I mean, this was a huge test of obedience for Gideon. Do I fear God more or do I fear my dad more? Right? I mean, this was a major test for Gideon. And then he said, offer the bullock on the altar. And it says there in verse 25, cut down the grove that is by it. I mean, that's mentioned again in verse number 28, that the grove was cut down. When we think of grove, we think of a grouping of trees that's planted on purpose. You know, a lot of times we talk about a pecan grove. If it's nut trees, we talk about a grove, and peach tree or fruit trees, we talk about an orchard, right? But a lot of times when we think grove, we think of a stand of trees that were maybe laid out intentionally, planted intentionally. That's not what this term means. This term here for grove has to do with a tree that was associated with idolatrous worship. But if you look at all of the uses of the term grove in the Old Testament, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles is primarily where you're going to find it. You see it some in the prophets as well. But you see this term, he made a grove. He set up a grove. He built a grove. Okay. Do those terms sound like, you know, naturally occurring, made, built, or set up? Not really. There's only one place in all of the Old Testament that I found where the term is used, he planted a grove. And even still, planted in the ground. I mean, if you have a post for your mailbox, did you plant it in the ground? In a sense, you did. Okay. You didn't plant it expecting leaves and fruit and such, but, you know, that's still the idea. So the idea of the grove here is something that was built, made, set up, established, and it was of wood. A lot of times it would be a pole that had a certain shape, and a lot of times there would be carvings on it. Sometimes it would be other decorations, but it would be carvings and inscriptions to the god or goddess that was being worshipped. A lot of times the term for grove here was associated with the female counterpart to Baal. Okay? But so this would be, in essence, an idol, a statue, a pole with carvings on it, whatever you want to call it, that would have been put right there near the altar to Baal that was part of the idolatrous worship. Okay, so when he's told to cut down the grove, it's not like they had to get axes and cross-cut saws and cut down a whole stand of trees in the middle of the night. But they did take down this, in essence, idol, statue, wooden pole that was associated with the idolatrous worship here. Verse 27, Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city. He knew if he did it in daylight and people saw him, they'd try to stop him. Because he feared those that he could not do it by day, he did it at night. I don't think this is a sign of weakness on the part of Gideon. I think this is a sign of wisdom. God told him to do it and get it done, and the best way to get it done was to do it at night, you know, without interruptions, without having to fight the people too. So verse 28, when the men of the city arose in the morning, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered on the altar that was built. So it looks like here, if you read this, the altar of Baal was cast down, a different altar was built in its place, and that second bullock, which may well have been used as a, you know, a tractor, so to speak, to pull down some of the rocks or pull down the idol or whatever, depending on the need there, then they took and offered that animal as a sacrifice to God. Hey, they would have recognized the remains on the altar and so forth. In essence, what he did is said, this is a place of defilement. We're going to get rid of the defilement, and we're going to try to sanctify this place, build an altar to the Lord, and try to restore the right kind of worship in its place. Now, this was on his dad's farm where this place was. Okay, but all the men of the city that worshiped Baal came to think of it as, this is my altar, this is my place of worship. Okay, which is why in verse 29, they said one to another, who hath done this thing? And when they inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. Then the men of the city said unto Joash, bring out thy son that he may die, because he has cast down the altar of Baal, and because he has cut down the grove that was by it. So who immediately went into the mode of avenging the wrong that was done? It was the men of the city. I'm sure Joash was aware of it at this point. He probably knew it was Gideon before they did. He wasn't quite as worked up about it as they were. Okay, so he, it's his altar, it's on his land, but it's kind of the city place of worship for Baal worship and such. And the men of the city are all up in arms. They said, we want him, hand him over, we're going to give the death penalty. Now, we understand in the law of Moses, as we call it, but God's law that he gave to Moses, the penalty for blasphemy and idolatry was the death penalty. We understand that. But I think it's very, very interesting what Gideon's dad said here. Okay, verse 31, Joash said unto all that stood against him, will ye plead for Baal? Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death while it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one has cut down his altar. I like it. I mean, I think Gideon's father here was a worshiper of Baal, but he's also trying to figure out a way to save his son from the mob, right? And he's like, really, fellas? Does God really need your help? If Baal is upset with my son for tearing down his altar, he's God. Let him strike him with lightning or fire from heaven. Let him smite him with a disease. If he's God, he doesn't need your help to avenge this. How do you answer that? Yeah, our God needs help. I mean, our God really can't do that. If we don't do it for him, it won't get done. You don't have much of a God, do you? I mean, you understand? He boxed them into a corner. He's like, hey, if Baal really is God, he can take care of this. If he needs your help, maybe he's not the God we think he is. Nobody at that point is going to publicly admit, yeah, our God's impotent. Our God needs help. I mean, it reminds me earlier in the book of Joshua, it's in 1 Samuel, when the sons of Eli took the ark out to the battlefield, and it was captured, and they put it in the house of Dagon. And when they came in the next morning, Dagon, it was falling down flat, worshiping in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And the statement is, they picked up Dagon and put him in his place. I'm like, some God. You know, you got to pick him up and set him on his little pedestal. He can't even help himself get up. I mean, it's the same thing here. Hey, if Baal's really God, let's see him, you know, send fire from heaven. Let's see him demonstrate divine judgment of some kind. Okay, I guess that's what we got to do. I mean, they're boxed into a corner now. Verse 32. Therefore, on that day, he called him. Now, I'm going to pronounce this differently than we normally do. I'm going to divide the word between the two B's right there. Jerub Baal. Okay, we say it Jerubbaal, usually. But it's Jerub Baal, all right, saying, let Baal plead against him. So many times in the Old Testament, you get a name like this, and the phrase right before it or the phrase right after it explains the meaning of the name. This is another one of those instances here, okay? Called him Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him. Okay? The name Jerubbaal, the Jerub part, is from a word that means to plead against. It's like a prosecuting attorney who's laying the charges out against him. Let Baal plead is a form of an imperative saying, hey, you know, let him deal with it. So they called him Jerubbaal, okay? Let Baal deal with him. That was his new name. They called him Jerubbaal, all right? Let Baal deal with him. Hey, there's old let Baal deal with him. You ever think about this? A month later, Gideon's still walking around. Baal hasn't dealt with him. 6 months later, Gideon's still walking around. Baal hasn't dealt with him. 5 years later, Gideon's still walking around. Why do we call him, let Baal deal with him? Every week, month, year that he lived after that was a testimony to the fact that Baal was powerless. Okay? It was a testimony to the fact that Baal was a false god, an impotent stump or stone, whatever they carved their idol out of. But that's what the term means, let Baal plead against him. It's basically like, may Baal judge him. May Baal prosecute him. And of course, we know Baal was powerless to do anything. And so Gideon lived and he's going to lead a great victory. But why did God ask Gideon to do this? I mean, from a religious standpoint, the idolatry needed to be dealt with. But from a personal standpoint, why did God ask Gideon to do this? What do you think? Any ideas? Very often, I mean, God counts obedience as obedience, right? And very often, God asks us just to do small things before he entrusts us with a larger thing, right? Doesn't the New Testament say, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much? And he that is unjust in that which is least is unjust also in much? Here, this was a test of obedience. It was a test of character for Gideon, but on a national scale, this was a very local, small thing that didn't make the news. I mean, it made the local news, but it didn't make the national news. The next thing God asked Gideon to do is going to make the national news. Okay? But God just simply asked him, do you love me? Do you fear me more than you fear man? Are you willing to obey what I told you to do, even if it's difficult? Gideon passed the test. Then what's God getting ready to ask Gideon to do next? Do you love me? Do you fear me more than you fear man? Are you willing to do what I tell you to do? It's the same process on a bigger scale, is what I'm saying. Okay? But here, Gideon had to face down not only his father, but I'm sure he had uncles or cousins or brother, you know, extended family that were Baal worshipers. I mean, he grew up here, so the men of the city knew him. I mean, this is his hometown where he took a stand against Baal, threw down the altar of Baal, offered a sacrifice to God, which from our view would sanctify the place. From the perspective of the Baal worshipers, he defiled the worship of Baal. Okay? So here, this was a test of Gideon's character and a test of his obedience, which he passed. All right, verse 33. Then all the Midianites and Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over. That's the others that I mentioned a little while ago that were confederate with the Midianites. And they pitched in the valley of Jezreel. All right, now, if you are a follower of, you know, prophetic events in the scripture, you know that the valley of Jezreel comes into view, you know, in end time events. It's a plain there in central Israel, okay? So, Jezreel, you have the valley of Jezreel. We're talking about central Israel. So, from here on out, Gideon was of, I believe, of the descendants of Manasseh. Very small family. But basically, you have everybody that was central and north on the west side of Jordan. Those were the ones that, I don't know if I can even replicate that. I guess it was just a puff of air. I don't know. We try to figure out what's causing the pop in the microphone, so I apologize for doing business in the middle of Sunday school, but we can't do it when pastor's preaching in the morning service. So, but basically, west of Jordan, between Jordan and the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean and the northern half of that land, that's the tribes that are going to be designated as the ones that helped Gideon here, okay? But when they pitched in the Valley of Jezreel, that's basically central Israel. So that's kind of, you know, dividing the land north and south, roughly. All right, verse number 34, but the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. That was his local area, his town or his tribe. Verse 35, he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh. If you remember, I'm sure all of you remember, not really, but I keep repeating it enough times, hopefully it'll help it stick. Okay, but there were 2.5 tribes on the east side of Jordan. That was Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. Okay, Gideon was of the other half of Manasseh that was on the west side. So when it talks about Manasseh here, that's primarily what it's talking about. Sent messengers throughout all Manasseh who gathered after him, and he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. Those are all tribes in the northern part. And we're talking about, again, the parts, but primarily between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean, there in north, and then there, and just a little bit south of there. So that's, you know, Manasseh, Asher, Naphtali, Zebulun. Some of these we heard about in the previous chapter with Deborah and Barak, the previous couple of chapters there. End of verse 35 says, they came up to meet them. Verse 36, Gideon said unto God. So here's what's interesting. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him. He blows a trumpet. He gets his local group. He sends from that group, I think, messengers out to the regional tribes. They all come, and he's got this big army. Now he's going to ask God if he should really do it. Seems a little bit out of order, doesn't it? But as a human being, I 100% agree with that. I mean, I 100% understand it. That's what I should say. You ever been like, yeah, this is something I need to do. Yeah, this is something we ought to do. Yeah, let's do it. You know, and then the next day you're like, what did I just do? Should I really do this or should I back out? You know what I mean? We kind of go through those processes all the time. And so Gideon, he sent out messengers, he's gathering an army, but now he needs some reassurance. You know, I think the Lord includes things like this to let us know we're not the only ones. I mean, Lord, I could use some reassurance here right now. You know, I probably should know better, but would you humor me? That's what I think is going on here, and I'll tell you why. Verse 36, Gideon said unto God, if thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, look at the last phrase of verse 36. What does it say? As thou hast said. Okay? So, in fairness to the whole situation, God told Gideon, I'm going to deliver Israel by your hand. He expected Gideon to believe his promise and to go forward. Gideon had the promise of God, but he was still, I could use some reassurance here. Good thing you and I never do that, right? We have the promise of God and we just charge forward without any hesitation, without any need for reassurance. No, we're like this too, okay? But he had the promise of God, as thou hast said. He could have gone forward and claimed the promise of God and said, Lord, you said you were going to bring victory, so now I'm asking you to do what you said. Verse 37, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be on the floor only and it be dry on all the earth, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand as thou hast said. It was so, he rose up early in the morning and thrust the fleece together, and it was wet. Okay, so best I can understand it, this was probably a threshing floor on top of a hill. It wasn't in the house, okay? But then, you know, he got to thinking, wait a minute. I mean, that's kind of normal. Well, you could start to explain this away. But notice in the, I left off the end of verse 38. He thrust the fleece together and wringed out of the fleece, how much water? bowl full of water. Now, I have to speak to the ladies for a minute because the men probably have no idea how much water you wring out of a dish rag. I mean, you get a dish rag sopping wet, get a bowl, put it on the counter, and wring it out. You might have enough water to fill up a fourth cup measurer, maybe. You know, half a cup. Not much at all, right? I don't even know the size of the bowl, but to me, that doesn't really matter. Now, granted, this is fleece, this is wool, so wool, when it gets wet, holds more water than cotton does. I'm totally aware of that. But you ever stop to think about how much water that was that he's wringing out of this fleece to fill up an entire bowl full of water? To me, what I'm saying is, normally, even as I understand it, this part of Israel typically had heavy dews. They didn't have as much rain, but they had heavy dews, which helped to provide the water that the plants and the crops would need. But, you know, to wring out an entire bowl full of water, I mean, maybe if you get a bath towel wet, sopping wet, you know, and you wring it out, maybe you get a bowl full of water that way. I don't know. But what I'm saying is he wrung out a bowl full of water. The fact that it's recorded that way kind of, I think, reinforces the fact that this was out of the ordinary. God, in his mercy, in his kindness, kind of went above and beyond to reassure Gideon. Yeah, it's not just going to be wet. I'm going to give you a bowl full of water. And Gideon, like so many of us, had an unlimited capacity to think, well, maybe this is what I asked for, but, you know, maybe I didn't ask right. You know, it's kind of natural. I mean, maybe the wool just holds water longer and it evaporated off the ground faster and the wool just holds water longer. And maybe I asked this wrong. I'm not sure if that was really the answer to my prayer or not. Let me try this again. I mean, we've never done anything like that, but Gideon did, right? Verse 39, Gideon said unto God, let not thine anger be hot against me, and I will speak but this once. What does that tell you? He kind of deep down already knows. He kind of already knows that he's on that edge, right? But nonetheless, he's going to ask one more time. Where have we heard this phrase before? Let not thine anger be hot against me. And I'm going to ask one more time. Yes. When Abraham was interceding for Lot and for Sodom, he said, don't be angry. Let not my Lord be angry with me. I'm just going to ask one more time. If there's 10 people, would you spare the city? Okay. So Gideon pretty much knows at this point. He said, I'm just going to ask one time. Let me prove, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and let the ground be dew. I mean, that would not make any sense otherwise. Verse 40, God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, and there was no dew on the ground. He picked up the fleece, feels dry. He's wringing it. Nothing's happening. So what does he do? In chapter 7, he starts with the army and goes. All right, now, what's the application for you and me? I mean, God had given Gideon a promise. Will you do what you said you would do? Will you deliver them as you said? I mean, when God had given him a promise, we need to learn to get to the point where that's enough. Okay? But Gideon, in his frailty, in his humanity, in his weakness of his flesh, said, Lord, would you give me a confirmation? This really is what you want me to do. Yes, son, I will. Here you go. Please don't get mad at me. You know, it's my fault, not yours. You know, it's not you, it's me, right? It's my fault, not yours. Could you please do it one more time and do it the other way? You know, if it was you and me, we'd probably be something like this. I already told you once. Now I've told you again. Go do what I told you to do already. Right? You don't believe me? You think I'm lying to you? I mean, if we were God, it'd be like, fine, I'm done with you. Find somebody else. What does the Lord do with Gideon here? All right, son, here you go. I'll do it again. All right, that should be enough. Go do what I told you to do. And to Gideon's credit, he did. Okay? I mean, it ought to be enough if God says it. But God, in his mercy, in his grace, in his long suffering, his kindness, however you want to phrase it, he humors us in our weakness sometimes. Psalm 103 says, he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. Okay? It's like, yeah, I really shouldn't expect too much. I mean, I made them out of mud, breathed life into them. They're a walking, breathing dirt ball. I shouldn't expect too much out of them. But you know, God in his mercy and long suffering, in his grace to us, when he does that, it's very important that we go and do what he wants us to do. Okay? It would be spitting in the face of God's kindness at that point to say, Lord, you know, I appreciate the miracle, I appreciate the confirmation, but I'm still not comfortable doing this. That, at that point, is going to be disobedience that is going to find disfavor with the Lord. Okay? But God was merciful. He gave Gideon an answer. I'm thankful for that. Why? Because I need it sometimes, and so do you. And when God confirmed it for him, he went forward and he saw a great victory and the Lord got credit for it and great things happened. But Gideon is a man that I think in many ways a lot of us can relate to. I mean, this was not, you know, David's mighty men that charged the giants with a spear or took the city or whatever. This is a regular guy that was afraid of how his dad and his family was going to react and, you know, I'm not sure how this is all going to go, but the Lord used him. He was a regular man who was willing to obey God. No big family, no big background. But if God used Gideon, that means he can use each of us in his service as well, right? As long as we're obedient and willing to trust God's word, trust his promise, and ultimately what that means is trust God's power. Gideon's going to get a great victory. We know God's going to shrink the size of his army, cut it down, so it's obvious, but it was always the power of God that was going to bring the victory. And the same thing's true of you and me. We can be ordinary people. It's the power of God that accomplishes the work of God. Thank you, Lord, for your word. And I pray now your blessings on the service to come. And Lord, I pray you'd help us as your children to be obedient to your word. And Lord, I thank you for your kindness and gentleness with us in confirming things. And Lord, I pray you'd help us to trust you and go forward as you lead and direct.